Hello and welcome back to the Fowler Hour. On today's show, I'm joined by Ben Howes of Howes Design Service from Columbus, Ohio. I think we've had more designers from Ohio on the show than anyone else at this point, so a bit of a shout out to them over in Ohio. Ben caught my attention originally when he was creating and sharing his State Park badge series on Instagram. But I very quickly fell in love with his work for a different reason. Ben focuses quite heavily on nature-related design work, from logos to illustrations. You can just scroll through his feed and see the connection this guy has with the natural world around him. On today's show, Ben is really open with us, which I wholeheartedly appreciate. We discuss how the words of one person can change your entire world forever, and why the journey of climbing a mountain makes the view from the top so much more rewarding. The last one on that list will make more sense towards the end of the show, so definitely stick around for that. I cannot thank Ben enough for being so open on today's show. Some of the ideas we discuss really hit home for me, and I think they will give you plenty to think about as well when you finish listening. Today's show is sponsored by Skillshare, an online learning platform dedicated to helping you grow your creative skills and build a successful business. Skillshare offering you 2 free months of unlimited video courses by signing up through our link skl.sh/cfowlerdesign. I've had a few messages from people who have already signed up saying how useful they found it for the last 2 months, but there was also a couple of questions basically saying, do I just get this particular course that you've mentioned? Do I have to only do one thing in 2 months? No, you get full access to everything on their platform for 2 months. A lot of the courses are between 1 and 8 hours long, so you can easily do 3 or 4 or even 5 of those in a 2 month period just on the side in your spare time. So once again, the link to get 2 free months of Skillshare and to learn from people like Mackie Saturday, Paula Scher, to learn from really great people in business as well. You've also got Aaron Draplin, who's got a new course out fairly recently too. To learn from all of these amazing creatives and entrepreneurs, you go to skl.sh/cfowlerdesign to get started. Right, let's get on with today's show. Hello, everyone, and hello. Welcome back to the Fowler Hour. I'll do that again, mate. Don't worry. You keep yourself quiet.
Yep. You got it.
Sorry, mate. I could edit this out later.
It's still earlier. I don't know what time it is in England, but it's still pretty early.
Okay. Take a sip. Deep breath. Zip it. So we're going in. 3, 2. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Fowler Hour. Ben doesn't know this yet, but I'm going to keep that intro in the podcast because it's absolutely hilarious. So today I'm joined by Ben Howes of Howes Design Service. He's a really interesting dude, and I've been following his work for quite a while now. You kind of popped out of nowhere, maybe sometime last year, with a lot of your Ohio kind of state park badges and a lot of the work relating to, it's just a lot of nature-related work. And I really enjoyed seeing the diversity of design that you shared on your account, Ben. Now, for people who may not know who you are, could you give us a few words about who you are, where you're from?
Absolutely. Well, my name is Ben Howes, and I'm 31 years old, and I'm from Columbus, Ohio. I was born in Lancaster, Ohio, which is about 45 minutes southeast. And so it's cool that Connor brought up the fact that nature inspires my designs, because literally I'm the product of a graphic designer, my mother, and my father was a naturalist. He was a park ranger. I also worked in botany, trail maintenance. And so growing up, I spent a lot of time in a bunch of nature parks in Ohio, the Hocking Hills region, as well as in my hometown of Lancaster, volunteering with my dad, helping him out. And then I also looked at the work that my mom had done for a glass factory called Anchor Hocking that she worked at. So that's a little bit of my background and a little bit that informs me today.
Well, what was that like growing up then? Did you spend a lot of time, maybe more so than your friends, kind of outside? Because
yes.
And rather than exploring, because at the time you would have been growing up, there would have been, there's not too many years difference between us, but there, the changing technology between those years are like teenage, late formative years. Everyone was getting stuck into like MP3 players and phones. Yep. And computers and laptops. So were you spending a lot of time with your dad, like out and about learning and exploring the world then?
That's a great question. So I actually have a very unusual upbringing. I was homeschooled. So my parents at that time were very skeptical of, they were fundamentalist Christians, And they were very skeptical of the way the world was going, as many people are today. And a lot of them thought that in their group of friends that the world was going to end. And so they kind of homeschooled us to shelter us from the world. And I mean, technology has changed a lot now, but my parents are older. They come from like my dad, he graduated, he actually marched in the first Earth Day Parade in 1970 in Cleveland. And my mom's a couple years younger, but they've seen culture and technology shift so much from the 1960s until you know, the 1990s when I started coming through the school system. And part of it's on me too, because I was also very kind of an ADD kid, very rambunctious, very imaginative. And so my parents thought it was best. And actually, to give them credit, it took a lot of work. There was four of us, and they decided to homeschool all of us for a time. So what that meant, we also lived in the countryside. So we lived right next to 61 acres of woods with a kind of like a small, like Black Hand Sandstone mountain in it. Not really a mountain. We called it a mountain, but it was really just a hill.
But it looked like one when you were a kid, though.
Oh, of course. Everything looks bigger when you're a kid, right? I thought my dad was a giant until I was, like 10 years old. I came by it, no pun intended, naturally. My dad worked for the state of Ohio as a park ranger. And even though my parents were really, conservative Christians and homeschooled us, they were great parents. And I had a great upbringing. But the consequence of that was I didn't really spend a lot of time with other people. I had a lot of time to ideate and to think through things and to be imaginative. And I volunteered with my dad. And I mean, we were barefoot and running in the woods all the time, you know, pretending that the mountain was like Lord of the Rings. I remember my friends and I would play that. We would have like courtroom dramas on top of the mountain, pretend that we were in a court, or pretend we were fighting different battles in the Civil War or World War II or whatever. So imagination and the outdoors was fundamental in my upbringing. And really, it still to this day informs what I do, as well as also my sense of independence as a graphic designer, because I always felt as a kid growing up that I was outside of the social norms. I was outside of the socially acceptable, way of doing things. And for a long time, that was hard for me to deal with. But now that I'm, in my 30s, it's actually been an asset for me, a competitive advantage. So I'm so used to going my own way and figuring out and learning the hard way, that I've actually been able to build a business for myself and do what I love for myself. It's been awesome. So,
yeah, I've heard that quite a few times from people who are homeschooled. There are many benefits to it because you can have much more direct and unique styles of learning. But of course, there does come a point where you step out into the world as a young teenager or someone with a bit more independence and you go, oh, geez, like things are very different. Like to what I was maybe taught, or maybe the way that things were shown and way things were described. Because when I read that, I briefly touched on your website earlier and looked at your father being a naturalist and your mum being a graphic designer. And I was like, how did you get involved with graphic design then? Because from my perspective, the idea of they're like polar opposites, and you hear about the best couples and make are typically polar opposites because they fit in with each other.
Yes,
but they are not just polar opposites in like goals, but in career paths, because you have to be attached to technology for graphic design now. You can't obviously, coming up through the 60s, you wouldn't have had that, but at the same time they feel like polar opposites to me. So I'd love to understand how that's grown into you, how those two paths have grown into you to make you who you are now.
Man, that's a great question, Connor. So obviously my mom, when she was a designer, professional designer, it was not so much about, there was no computers in her office. It was, Linotype, and it was light boxes, and you would draw out your typography. Like, she had class after class of just drawing Helvetica to make sure that she got all the weights and proportions right so that she could just freehand it. My mom also was an illustrator. She did fashion illustration. That was actually her major at Columbus College of Art and Design. She graduated in the early 80s. And so even then, there was no computers. And even as much as like 15, 10 years ago, when I was going to school, friends weren't working with computers at art schools. So it is a very new innovation. But okay, so my the answer to the question is twofold. Like, how do you bridge the gap between the natural, non-technological component and the obviously always in front of the computer component of today's graphic design workflow? And the other question is, how did I arrive at it? So I'll answer the second question first. Growing up, I didn't really have a lot of direction for my life. I was a creative person. I was very rambunctious, and I was hard for, it was hard for my parents to kind of corral me or direct me into any one direction, because I was interested in a lot of things. I've always been pretty smart. I've always loved history, always loved music. In our household, we were not allowed to listen to secular music because, you know, that's just the culture that I was raised in. However, my dad, growing up through the 60s, loved bands like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, the Guess Who, the Who, Moby Grape, all these like Paul Revere and the Raiders, a lot of English bands too, Dave Clark Five. And so I would go down into his workshop, in the Peter workshop. I'd go down into the basement of our house in the middle of kind of the woods. And he, that's the only place where I could listen to things that weren't this absolutely terrible Christian music. That was so boring. It's such a cheap knockoff. It's like, yeah, if you've had like Coca-Cola and then you have like, in America, it's called Big K. It's like, you get it at a Kmart. It's like a knockoff of Coca-Cola. That's what Christian music was, the secular music. It was so embarrassing.
Watered it down.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. It left you with a stomachache. But no, but I just hated that stuff. But my dad would let me listen to his music with him. And what that did from a young age was gave me a love of music, right? And so that love of music also came with a love of art, because I would look at these album covers from the time, especially the late 60s. So I'm actually a guitar player and a bassist, and I really got into like late 60s psychedelic rock and like 70s hard rock. And a big part of that scene was the t-shirts and the albums. I just loved how the colors looked, especially psychedelic colors. I loved how they vibrated, kind of drew you into a world. And again, growing up, we were pretty anti-technology too. Like, I was allowed to be on the computer for 1 hour a day, and I would play this game called Age of Empires. I don't know if you know that game, yeah, but as being a history buff, I play Civilization now. I love history.
Oh, geez, man, you must have like, you must be committed to play Civilization. Like, for people at home, like, Civilization is like a turn-based strategy, yep, game. It's very similar to Age of Empires, but it's a tile-based game, hex-based, yes, system. Yes. But a game is hours long. Like, depending on how you play it, I've watched people do streams of it and they'll be there for like 6 hours. And it's just, I can't commit. I could not commit to that. But you're right. I had the same thing growing up. I'd only be allowed on the computer for like an hour or so a day, or playing games.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of Civilization, I'm like, I think I have like a 4 or 5 month game going that I'm still working on, because I don't have time. I just can't commit the time to it because I have a pretty busy life with everything that I do, but I love it. It's my refuge, but that's beside the point. So anyway, growing up, I was in a rock band. And so obviously I grew up in a very kind of repressive, restrictive environment, and I'm a free thinker, always have been. And you know, my dad's mom were parents of the 60s, and that's what they went through. So I kind of just made my own way, and I got into rock as almost a rebellion, like punk rock and classic rock as a rebellion against the culture I grew up in. And, you know, so, and everything that comes along with that. I know, obviously it's a podcast, but I'm bald. But when I was a kid, man, I had like really long brown hair, and I really looked the part. I kind of looked like, my goal was to look like Jimmy Page from Zep. Nice. He was my hero. I terrified my parents because he also was into Aleister Crowley and like black magic and stuff. He but yeah, exactly. So anyway, as I was growing up, I was in a band in college. I went to Ohio University in Athens. And so this is actually a really pivotal part of my life. This is why I became a graphic designer. Growing up, I'd always seen logos everywhere. I remember going into town. And remember, I felt so isolated from the rest of the world, which nowadays, now the world is so hyper-connected, and everyone can tweet at the president or the prime minister, or everyone can call each other names. I actually kind of miss the way it used to be, because back then you had to write people letters, or you had to, you know, send them emails, and you had dial-up that took about a year and a half to get online. But the world felt a lot bigger when I was younger, and also I was younger. But I remember going into town of Lancaster where I grew up, and I would see the McDonald's Golden Arches, or I would see a train go by with a logo on it, and think to myself, wow, that looks official. Like, that's something that the rest of the world has that I feel like I'm missing out on. Because I wasn't allowed. The only television I could watch was public television. So we watched Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and Reading Rainbow and all these different shows growing up. And I felt like I was missing out on the world. And every time I saw a logo, I felt like I was getting a glimpse in, like a portal of what the actual real world is. Turns out, the older I get, the real world isn't that great. And sometimes it's scaling away from it that makes things better, hence my love for nature, right? But anyway, as a kid, I was fascinated by it. But in high school, I just wanted to play music. I wanted to be a rock star. In college, I didn't really study hard. And I dated this girl, and I really liked her, and she was a musician, and I thought, you know, things were going to go further. And then she broke up with me, and I was very depressed. And I mean, if I'm going to be frank, I was depressed to the point of suicide, because I felt at that time in my life, I was actually 21 years old, so I got a late start. But I felt that I was studying organizational communication, which pretty much is like studying breathing. You know, it's something that, you know, you might have a degree in it, but what exactly does it do other than the base assumption? Yeah. Exactly, right? So I didn't really have any direction. I didn't know what I wanted out of my life. And I kind of felt hopeless. And I felt like this weird kid my whole life, about to make this transition into the adult world, which is a very scary thing to do. And so one weird thing that my family has done since 1979, my dad started this thing called Frontier Spirit. And what that is a historical reenactment about the founding of our town of Lancaster, Ohio, which was a bunch of Pennsylvania Dutch immigrants from New Lancaster, or from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, came and settled it. And so I've been a part of that for a long time. And as a musician, I played music in the scene on the trail. It's a trail that people walk through and they can learn about the history of Lancaster. It's actually really cool. I'm still part of it to this day. But there's a gentleman named Martin Barker. And in my town of Lancaster, graphic design is not a priority. I mean, Comic Sans abounds, papyrus abounds, you know, bad kerning is everywhere. Like distorted text and horrible garish multicolor logos are everywhere, clip art logos. I mean, it was embarrassing. But there was one guy named Martin Barker who was a graphic designer in my town. And everything he did was professional. And he would brand the bank in our town, Fairfield Federal. He would brand these different companies. And I knew that there was somebody in Lancaster. I didn't know who it was, but I knew there was somebody that knew what he was doing. And his stuff was just, well, you know, relatively just as good as something you'd see in Columbus or something. And so I ended up being in the scene with him on the trail. And I'd just gone through this breakup. I'd gone through this hard year. And I was kind of sharing this stuff with him. And he had the boldness to look at me and say, Ben, I could tell you're a very creative person. I could tell you have a lot of thoughts. It's like you have a storm that's brewing inside of your head. It's like a creative storm full of a bunch of electrical potential energy. But unless you target that energy and strike it at something, you're always going to be restless and you're always going to be stormy. And he actually had the boldness to say, you need to pursue graphic design and give it all you got. And my parents, you know, what they wanted me to be a pastor or a missionary, which isn't me. I'm not really a religious person anymore. But they didn't see that in me, but this guy did. And this power, the power of him saying that, gave my life direction. And so that's how I started pursuing design at 21 years old, 100% self-taught. I've never taken a design course, didn't go to art school at all. I just have had a hunger from that day, because I realized how bleak my life was. And I realized that graphic design was essentially a life preserver, or like a flotation device that could bring me to something else. And I still struggle with mental health to this day at certain times. I think I'm manic depressive at times. I know I'm getting really open, but that's all right, because I feel like a lot of people are in the same boat. And I want my life to, you know, help people out if I can. But design has always been a central, natural thing for me, and so has the outdoors. And they've both been these oases of peace in my turbulent mind and in this turbulent world. And so, yeah, so that's that component. And I think there was another question, but I've spoken for so long, I can't remember what
no,
I was.
No, it's fine, man. So just hearing back from that story, there's a couple of things that I wanted to touch on that you mentioned. Well, firstly, it's amazing that you had someone who came into your life like that and gave you that guidance that you needed, because
I'm forever grateful. And
where would you be without it, do you think? Do you think you'd still be kind of fumbling around, maybe not quite sure what to do with your degree or where to go next?
So my town of Lancaster is called the Black Hole because it's a small working class.
One of those, is it?
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Probably like Birmingham over in the UK or something like that. But
yeah, it can be.
Yeah, I don't know where you're from. But yeah, like, you know, those like small industrial working class towns where family's strong and tight, but there's also a lot of poverty. In my town, there was a lot of heroin usage. And I had a lot of friends that, you know, were artistic or creative. They just never broke away. And even to this day, they're still living there. And don't get me wrong, it's a beautiful place. It's a great place with great people. But I think I would have probably been there. I worked at Chipotle for a while. I worked at Office Max in the print department. But because I taught myself design, I ended up getting a job in Columbus at a tech company. And I was like a low level, entry level, like digital designer. And I did some UI, UX stuff. And I did a lot of print stuff too. And because of that, because of Martin, I'm going to say his name, Martin Barker. Because of Martin Barker, I pursued design. And that got me a job in Columbus. Because of that, I was able to go into a coffee shop one day and see my beautiful wife working and making coffee and ask her out. And because of that, you know, we got married and now we have a house and now I have this business. So if it hadn't been for that one moment in time and that boldness of that one person to speak something into me that I couldn't see in myself, man, I'm getting a little emotional here, man. I don't know, right, dude. I don't know where I'd be.
Take a minute if you need to. But
yeah,
you're right.
So
totally. And being able to have that input is something that I think many people miss. And many people don't feel they ever receive. And I think that all of the things that went on in your life up to that point all lead up to that. And you talk about Lancaster being a black hole. But maybe it's not just a black hole. Maybe it's just a case of there are not so many opportunities there. But when you find one, you have to grasp onto it like it's a lifeline. And that's exactly what you did. So the fact that you've taken that, you should feel very proud of that. The fact that you took that chance and you leapt on top of it and you ran with it. Because I'm not from a town as similar like Lancaster, where you would deem it a black hole. But the place I live is live and raise a family here. Like that's what this town is for. This is like one of these in-between a city type towns.
Sure.
And I'm very much in the boat. At the moment, I live with my parents just while things are building up with the business. But
of course,
I feel the same way. So without things like being able to do this podcast or to meet people like yourself and hear your story or to talk to people like Chris Doe or all the other people in the community that I talk to, it would feel very lonely and it would feel very desperate trying to make this work. And I think that from the story that you've just explained, you had someone come into your life and really kind of go, this is it. Grasp on, hold tight. And you ran with that.
There's a story from the Bible that I remember reading as a kid about the apostle Paul on the road to Damascus. And like he was one way in his life. He was like a killer of a torturer of Christians or whatever. And then he had this moment on the road where like scales fell out of his eyes. And I can't remember. It's been a while since I read the story. But essentially it was a turning point for him. And he ended up his life being changed by what happened to him, but he ended up going out and evangelizing and trying to change other people's lives. And actually, I use that as an example. So, you know, I don't know if God exists or what exists out there, but cosmic fate or whatever it is was there with me on that day, and it gave me a second chance. And so in order to repay that, that's why I always jump on the chance to tell my story on podcasts. I do portfolio reviews at an art school in Ohio, even though I never went to art school. I don't even know what an art school is like, but I know what looks good and what doesn't, and I know how I can encourage them. And you know, to an earlier point you made, I just met yesterday with this really talented gentleman who goes to a school called Otterbein, and they have a very small graphic design program here in Westerville, which is close to where I live. And he's really sharp, and his work is good, and he's like a second-year student. But he told me, and I said, do you mind if I critique your work? And I said, I'll tell you what works, I'll tell you what doesn't. And he was kind of scared of it at first. I'm like, well, why are you intimidated? He's like, I'm spending all this money to go to this art school, and nobody, my professors, my students, nobody critiques my work. And I'm like, man, like that. And I think when you get onto the online component these days, there are so many people that it's an echo chamber. People copy other people. I've copied people before. I'll admit it. Everybody does in order to learn. And everybody is always saying, great job, nice job, that looks good, whatever. But I feel like there's a lack of, hey, like, what if you did this? Or hey, how can I help you solve this problem? And so I feel like, I guess the point I'm trying to make with all this is that we have this power as designers, especially us who have, you know, I have almost 10,000 followers. I know you have a massive following yourself, and other folks like Brendan, who was on the podcast, and my friend Ethan, who was on your podcast as well. He lives in Ohio close to me. Those are great guys. And like, and I know them as they're good people too. We have this awesome opportunity to not only put out great work and get paid for it, but also encourage other people and help them have a seat at the table that we've been fortunate enough to have a seat at as well. And so that's part of my mission as a designer is to try to give back however I can and help other people live this dream of working for yourself in a way that you couldn't have done 20, 30 years ago. So,
yeah, and that's an amazing mission to have. I think that's a very noble thing to be doing, because especially when you come from a place that is not LA, that is not New York, that is not one of these massive big hitters, that you do empower creativity where you find it. So when you gave this critique to this person, did they respond positively to what you said? Although they might have been intimidated at first, was it a case of they took it on with a bit of pride and a bit of, well, we'll do better next time? Or were they very kind of anti what you were saying?
It was cool, man. So when I critique somebody, I try to do the sandwich thing where it's compliment and then the critique and then a compliment. And a lot of his work was actually really good. And so in my critique, I wanted to pull out, and point to the things that were strong. And then also say a couple things that could be improved and give a reason for why they could be improved. Like text alignment on certain things, different icons with different thicknesses and the strokes, like minor things, the wrong type choices, because that's how you learn. And he was very responsive because he has a hunger and a thirst to want to be the best he can. And he wants to work for himself one day. And so he called me up and he just wanted to talk about my story. And, you know, he's a young kid, bright kid. He's got a sketchbook full of all these ideas that he's done, and he's learning. Like, the technical skills will come in time in terms of computer tools, but some people just have a sense of form and a sense of structure and a sense of balance that you really can't, you can teach it, but some people have it innately, and this gentleman did. And I guess the reason that I'm not afraid to critique someone, or because I care about that, and I want them to succeed, just like Martin did for me. Like, he pretty much critiqued my life and said I wasn't going anywhere and that I had to do something about it. And so it was kicking the ass, but I'll never forget that moment. And so if I can kick somebody in the ass, and I think someone who does, you know, a really good job of that is like someone like Draplin. Obviously, he's inspired, you know, a million graphic designers out there, myself included, to go out there and to think outside of the structure of the 9 to 5, and Christo as well, you know, and Mike Jones down at Creative South, and a lot of these folks, they kick in the pants. And I think we live in a culture today where everything is so instant gratification and everything is so permissible to everybody that when everything is open to you and nobody is criticizing you, and if they do, that you attack them, you know, then you have this big insecurity that nothing in your life that you're doing is actually amounting to something. It's easy to throw rocks and stuff, but it's harder to take rocks and build something out of them, right? And so I feel like people that are bold enough to come into the cultural stream and say something to people and call them up to a higher standard is far more helpful than hurtful if it's done with the right heart behind it, the right motivation behind it. And I think that's what can transform people's lives. And yeah, so.
I wonder what led to this person's class and these professors not being willing to give feedback, because I have my partner, Lydia. This episode is coming out, fortunately, after she finishes her course. But her course is not great. And she's basically in the same situation where her professors are outdated. Her professors do not provide feedback. And they don't actually provide any teaching or structure. So you go in to do this course in illustration, but they don't teach you how to be an illustrator. It's a case of do your own thing for 3 years and we'll say yes or no. And it makes me wonder how things got to that point and whether things like outrage culture, which is what you're talking about with social media, and general pessimism and a desire for instant gratification has caused this, because people not only can have access and look at things online all the time to compare themselves, but they then beat themselves up about that and become very defensive about their own work. So
that's right.
To be able to connect with someone as you did, who is open to criticism, is extremely powerful, because they will go on, hopefully, to be better than they ever could have imagined. But without that guidance, you just, it's just a self-feeding cycle, isn't it? You, people don't take on critique, they lash out. And then when they, for some reason, feel the need to pass on critique to someone else, they get surprised when it's not received. And you have to be both equally receptive to it as giving it, because there is very much a thing of unsolicited advice.
Yes, for sure.
But it appears that in this case, the gentleman's course he is on, these professors aren't even doing that. That's not even like the bare minimum. Like, if you're on a course with no feedback, I'd much rather have unsolicited, like, I'd rather have a professor leaning over my shoulder going, "This is crap, mate. This is what you need to do to fix this." Than like enough, than nothing. And it does make me wonder what has led into this, because it could be access to information. It could be ease of, because you can go to YouTube and learn half the stuff you learn at uni. Like, you can do that. Yeah. But that's like no good for, why would you go to the course for that? And it does really make me wonder what led to that. Because I can't imagine when, for instance, your mum was in design school learning there, I'm sure there was plenty rounds of feedback in that case.
Oh, yeah. Brutal, brutal.
Exactly. Criticism.
Well, I have some thinking on that. So back when my mom was in school, that was really when like the Swiss designers and like international style was pretty much like the authoritarian rule over all graphic design. You know, like, this is how it's done. This is how corporate design is done. We're gonna follow the Massimo Vignelli, Paul Rand, Saul Bass model. And everybody's going to go down that Lance Wyman. That's the road we're going to go down, right? And so I think that has led to the professors that maybe in your partner Lydia's case and my friend in Otterbein's case, it's led to kind of this encrusted design culture. So I think up until the advent of social media and accessible internet tools, which really have democratized design for anybody, design is kind of was like a closed camp. And it was like this mysterious, this is exactly what it's like. The design before the early 2000s was like the Catholic Church, where there's a bunch of, or the Anglican Church, where there's a bunch of rituals, and the priests go and deliver the sacrament, and they go behind the, you know, the altar, and they do all their incantations, and they speak a language that the commoner can't understand. And then, you know, the parishioners just have to take whatever they're given and trust that it's good. But then the computer was like the Gutenberg's printing press. And then in the early 2000s, it was like the Protestant Reformation. And people said, no, I reject this notion. I can do this on my own. And so I think that there's been a reaction by the intelligentsia and the professorial class against this movement, because they are trying to, number one, fight off any competition that would loosen or I guess lessen the value of what they do. And they're afraid that they're going to lose control of the sacred texts or the interpretation of what the holy gospel of graphic design is, right? And as you've seen in Protestantism, especially in America, now everybody's got a church, and there's a billion different denominations. And imagine those denominations, those branches of churches, being people's YouTube accounts or Instagram accounts or Dribbble pages, right?
Paul Randism, Massimo Vignelliism.
Exactly. The redeemed church of thick lines of St. Aaron Draplin, you know, or whatever, you know? But I think that's an apropos analogy.
To like a Photoshop, someone Photoshop Draplin with like his holiness.
Oh dude, he had an aura around his head. And yeah, dude, I can totally see it, man. And like the angels are his dog, Gary, who passed away, unfortunately, just flying around in the cosmos.
I agree with you, though. Like, I agree. But I really, just to jump in on that point, it's really difficult to tell, because sometimes I think that people who would be called the intellectual leaders of the industry or teachers in general for the industry, they're either looking down on these new technologies and kind of in a pessimistic way, or it's potentially something similar but slightly different. It's that they have no willingness to adopt these new technologies and these new ideas. Now, there is a distinct difference. They're both fairly pessimistic outlooks, but the difference between not wanting to take it's two very slightly different things. But when it comes down to teaching other people, I think you are required. You should be required in the same way many, I don't know what it's like in the UK, but I know in certain states in the US, if you're a doctor or a lawyer, you have to renew your certifications. You have to keep up to date. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a requirement of all teachers, which is literally a clip before we started recording today, Ben, from Chris Doe. He was talking about how he heavily analyzes the Futures Channel in terms of, well, how do I make this better? Where do I need to learn the next thing from? What books do I need to read to help the people who are watching me? How do I? And absolutely, it's the same principle. And the fact you're taking on that, it's not, I'm not sure it's quite a burden, but the idea that you are taking on that weight to pass on that knowledge as best you can is a really good quality to have for someone in this industry, because you're right. The sacred texts are out there for everyone to look at now. And there's no reason not to be sharing it.
And to add on to that, so I was going to finish the point I was making before, I think with education, and this is an interesting direction this has taken, but I think it's a good point. I think a lot of people are still, they were trained in the Catholic Church, quote unquote. You know, that's the catechism they know, the dogma they know, the mass that they know. But now it's a post-Catholic era in terms of design, you know, quote unquote. Universal, because Catholic means universal. So there was this Swiss International style, that's universalism in a sense, right? A very, this is what graphic design is. But now it's so segmented and there's so many different denominations. I think that the older professors are tenured. In the case of the gentleman I met with yesterday, his professor is checked out. He's 60 years old. He wants to, you know, stop teaching. So he no longer has a vested interest in the students as much as he did before. But thirdly, I think that the other issue is that it's art school, and this is going to be controversial. I never went to art school, but I've had a lot of conversations with people who have. Art school is meant to prepare and prime people to be cogs in a machine, to either work at an agency, and there's nothing wrong with this. I mean, there are people, I'm pretty extroverted for a graphic designer, but there are people that are very shy and introverted, and they're right at home at an in-house situation or at an agency. And I think art school prepares you for that agency life or in-house life. But I think that what art school should do is they should have, you know, an industry track, an agency track. They should also have an entrepreneurial track. Because I was talking to my friend about this yesterday, the gentleman from Otterbein, and I said that going to art school is kind of like going to the gym and you're working out just one targeted muscle, right? Like you go to a machine and you're doing your bicep curl. That's all you do. Starting your own business is like deadlifting or doing squats where you're working out your entire body. And because you have to be your own, for, at least in my case, your own PR, your own marketing, your own accountant, your own project manager. You have to get the work done. You have to hustle people to pay you and make sure your invoices come in. You have to keep records for taxes. You have to think about business development. And that's why, you know, people like Chris and what he does is so inspirational and informative, because you know, he helps people with that process. But yeah, I think that to put a cap on the whole university situation, I think that right now we're just in the middle of this paradigm shift. And I don't think it's because so many professors have been tenured into the role that it's going to take a couple more years to recycle that through. But I think eventually it's going to change. I mean, everything is always in a state of evolution and change. And so I think the students 10, 20 years from now will learn how to build a successful Instagram account and YouTube channel or Twitch stream or whatever the next medium comes into the future. So I just think we're just in the middle of that sea change right now.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I don't want to dive too hard into the whole university agency topic because my God, my brain on that goes nuts. So let's move forward on a little bit. And please. Keeping on the idea of working kind of in-house and moving through to being a freelancer, now that you are a freelancer, you've worked with some really interesting companies. One of which of those is Waze. Now, I look at your work, and not to kind of be like, oh, Ben couldn't do this, but I look at your work and I see the passion you have and the content and the curation you have between the idea of a lot of the stuff you share is nature-related. And that's fabulous, because that's clearly where you're most passionate and that's where the work is.
Yeah.
But you also work at a company called Waze. And now I know Waze is kind of alternative Google Maps type tech startup. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that list, I've got to ask you what it was like to work with that type of company, because it's not often that I'm talking to someone who has worked with a company that I can actually name. I can actually go, oh, you can go and check them out. Waze have been helping me get around and help people all over the country and the world. So what was it like working with them? What's the story behind that?
Well, I don't want anybody to get illusions of grandeur that it was this massive, you know, UI overhaul or anything. It's a great question, because this came at a pivotal time in my jump to freelance. So I worked in-house, and then I was freelancing on the side, and I had built up a Dribbble following, a decent-sized Dribbble following at the time, as well as a decent-sized Instagram following. And so people kind of knew my work and knew what was out there. But at this time, I think in so many designers' journey, especially as they go out on their own, they're trying to come up with, what is my signature style? What can I do? And so this was back in 2017, and a gentleman who worked for them, I think a creative director or an art director, just found me on Dribbble, and he said, hey, we are interested in hiring you to create a series of Facebook advertisements, taking a couple of concepts about Waze and about, you know, like how it can help you save time and traffic and all these things, and illustrate that. And it was an awesome opportunity, but I'll be honest with you, I think I dropped the ball on it, because I wasn't there in terms of my aptitude, in terms of my ability. So the opportunity was there, and I did my best on it, and I ended up just making just one of them. And I never know if it was even used on Facebook. I'm really not Facebook anymore. But I mean, I got paid for it and everything. And I thought it was a decent comp and a decent design. But now I would have approached it a lot differently. I think that there was just a lot I didn't know. I really don't know why they selected me to do it, to be honest. But I don't know how I could dive in deeper in that, other than just to say that it was at a time where I had not yet come across what's become my bread and butter, which is kind of more natural, retro, mixed in with a little bit of psychedelia. Wheelhouse that I've arrived at with the last year and a half. This is when I was trying to find my footing. And I feel like, to be honest, this was a humbling experience, because I didn't execute it as well as I could have, and as I would have if I, you know, had the chance now. So if you're listening, Waze, give me another shot. And maybe we could do some like off-road nature 4x4 kind of stuff.
So you were talking just then, was this when you were transitioning between being in-house and freelance? Did you still have a full-time job?
Yes, I think I got this like right, because I transitioned from full-time to freelance in July of 2017. And I think that this whole Waze thing happened like right at the end of that.
Right. So, okay. So you were like, you were fresh faced. You were like ready to go. Right. Okay. So it's interesting that you look back on it in that reflective manner of, we could have done things differently. But do you feel that, based on the experience you had, this is 2017, bear in mind, guys, this is 2 years prior to the recording of this. So in that period of time, a lot has changed, clearly. But do you feel when you were in that moment that you had dropped the ball, or do you think it was you taken on something that maybe was a bit too big?
Yeah.
Right.
I feel like that
at the time you felt it was maybe a bit much.
Yes, but I was, at that time, I was so desperate to make it happen and to bring money in and to make a freelance career work that I decided to go for it. And honestly, I think that was the right call to make, because as long as I can look back and reflect and say, okay, what would I do differently now? Where did I succeed on this project? Where did I fail? As long as you look back critically, all of your failures, or not even failures, but all of your disappointments could be training grounds for future successes, if you're willing to learn from them. I think a lot of people get a paralysis of putting something out there, and then they don't get a lot of likes, or they don't get a lot of feedback, or they don't feel good about it, and so they kind of shy away. For me, man, I just, you know, back then when I was starting to freelance, I just cranked stuff out, and a lot of it wasn't very good. But I was trying to find my voice, and I'm like, well, if I keep throwing the spotter out there, I'm going to eventually accrue a following, and if I keep practicing and listening to what people are commenting and what they're saying about my work, I'll find a direction. And when I look at the posts that get the most likes, I can beta test the direction that I should go in. And then I kind of found that direction, and then people started reaching out to me for that. And so really, for someone like myself who doesn't have the reference of art school, or I'm kind of like figuring out as I go, to be honest, like building a plane in the middle of the air. And so I always have to be critical of myself and reflective and look back and see what works and what doesn't work. And I'm always trying to push myself and not stay in just one lane and create just one style of things. I know you touched on before we talked about the diversity of the kind of styles that I do. I'm always trying to look for the next move. Like I look out now, like if you follow the hashtag like distressed unrest or look at the work of like Lincoln Design Co. Like I love that kind of stuff, man. Like that stuff is top notch. It's killer. And for a while when I started, I was really influenced by Draplin because, you know, I love that aesthetic and I loved his personality. And I never ripped off his work, but I definitely was heavily influenced by it. But in the last couple of years, my question has been, how do I move away from being a Draplin clone or a Draplin ripoff to creating something that's more unique to myself? And then how do I take my, now I'm like, how do I take that part of my career and use it still to inform the work that I do now, but yet still create something that's innovative? And I feel like the Ways thing tied all back together was one of those times where, you know, I showed up, I wasn't as prepared as I could have been, and I learned for the future. And yeah, I feel like since then, I haven't repeated some of those mistakes. So
it's interesting that you look back on it like that.
How so?
There is such a rush and such a sense of fear almost in many people that they have to find their style. Mm-hmm. They have to find exactly their carving immediately, exactly the axe that they're going to cut this tree down with, like exactly how they're going to do from A to B. And as you've just explained there, many, many people take a long time to get there. I mean, you don't look at people even like the greats, like Picasso, you an artist and fine artists, you don't go and look at their work and go, oh yeah, like their first piece was their best piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might be a nice piece of history, but it's never going to be the final thing that they create. And most people in their lives will find and get their stride after many years of trial and error, many years of experimentation, and then finally realizing at some point that, oh, actually, why don't I just do what I want to do? Or why don't I just try this or try that or blend these two things together? And you talk about, was it distressed unrest? Like the... Mm-hmm. Oh, their style is, for those who don't know, it's quite illustrative, but it blends a lot of almost what I would like to call kind of post-war American illustration, like heavy characterization, lots of thick line work, monoline work, lots of bright colors and vintage distress. So if you think about the closest comparison I have now, you think about how the games, the video game Fallout is. A lot of their, a lot of the stuff you see in games like Fallout in this dystopian world reflect in things like the Forefathers group, Lincoln Design Co., some of Young Jerk's stuff as well.
John Contino.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact you've recognized, oh, well, I was doing this style and then we've gone, oh, maybe we can try and explore some of this or bring some of these ideas in and mash these things together and then put a bit of psychedelia in as well and all these other influences. People forget that. People forget that it takes a long time. And to go full circle back to Ways, it takes years. It's been 2 years almost since you did that job. And how do you feel now in comparison? Do you feel much more prepared to take on a challenge like that again or something bigger in terms of your workflow? Or even, because you said working every muscle in your body as in terms of accountant, website, PR, marketing, everything like that. So in that 2 year time span, how far do you think you've come?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, see, it's, the first part is obvious. So any art directors or creative directors, get a hold of me. I'm raring to go. I'm ready. And if you dig my style, I'd love to work with you, no matter if you're big or small. I just got to throw that out there. But I think that's actually kind of a key to this. So 2 years ago, I think a lot of people are in this position where they look at so many different things and they think to themselves, oh, I love Andy J. Miller from Creative Pep Talk. I love his illustrative fun style. Oh, I love thick line style, like John Contino's style. I really like what Nick Slater's doing with his like tech illustrations. And I got to do all of it. But, and I tried doing that at first, and I wasn't good at all of it because, you know, like, you learn as you go. But I feel like it's like making a stew over a long time. Like, you start with your base ingredients, and those are your influences. Those are your passions. And you let those cook. You let those mature. And then you throw in like a dash of inspiration spice from a couple channels that you follow on YouTube or Instagram or Dribble. And then you throw in maybe some other stuff, and it blends together, and it matures, and it creates this interesting flavor profile that's unique to yourself. There's a quote by, I think it's Paul Rand, who says, you don't have to be original, you just have to be good. And honestly, I think the best way to get started for anybody is, in myself, is kind of not rip off people who are doing it great, but figure out, like, reverse engineer their work and say, how do they do that? How do they come to this final conclusion for this design? And with things like Skillshare and YouTube tutorials, it's easy to kind of see that. But that kind of allows you to get in the trenches and figure out how to make these things, right? And so for me, I've learned, like, you know, when I first started 2 years ago, I said, I'll do websites, I'll do motion graphics, which is a joke. You know, I'll do print design and everything. But now I've gotten to a point where I don't do that stuff for the most part. I do web every once in a while, and I can do that. And I can do print design and, like, corporate design. I have a corporate client, actually, a small one, a financial advising firm. And the stuff I do for them, I never show. But it's very nice, grid-based, good work, but it's not the kind of work that I want to attract. So I put the bait out there for the fish that I want to catch, right? I don't want to be – there's a million graphic designers in the world. I don't want them to hire me to just be a seat in the butt to do something that anybody else can do. I want them to hire me because they like my style. They like my energy. They like my aesthetic, and they want to work with me. Those are the kind of fish that I'm trying to catch, you know? And so 2 years ago when I worked for Waze, it was like I just threw my line into whatever pond I could to catch, you know, a guppy or a shark or whatever, you know. And nowadays I'm like, no, I want people that want to work with me because they see the value of what I do. They see the craftsmanship that I put into my work, and they think that that could really supplement or boost their brand. So does that answer your question?
It does, yeah. And you're right. And the journey you've taken to get there is very important because it takes that time. It takes 2 years to go, okay, well, we're going to go throw in these 16 different types of bait into the water and see what bites. And sometimes nothing will bite. And you have to sit there and go, why did nothing bite? Why is this not working? And then you sit and have a bit of self-resentment, and then you go, actually, we'll try again. and everyone goes through that process, and you have to chuck it out there.
And I'll tell you what, Connor, that's the worst feeling in the world, is to be a married man and, you know, like, not have work come in. That's what happened when I started. Like, it was so disheartening. And I gotta tell you guys this, like, mental health matters. And this actually ties into the natural component of things. Like, you gotta have a life outside of this. You gotta be passionate about this. But if design is all you ever think about, all you ever work on, it's gonna burn you out really quick. So for me, I was just at first, and this is the stuff you learn as you go. Like, nobody was calling me. I was getting like $200 jobs every month or whatever. I mean, it was terrible. And then in January of 2018, the one thing that changed everything for me was I you can look, see it on my Dribble or my Instagram feed, but I illustrated this boot. And I remember I was in visiting my wife's family in California. I was at a Starbucks, and I was just kind of feeling a sunny day, beautiful, 70 degrees, beautiful blue azure sky. The mountains, San Gabriel Mountains, were next to me. And I just was like, man, I just got done hiking, because hiking is what I love to do outside of design. I'm like, man, I want to capture in the design how hiking makes me feel. And I thought about this thing, and I think that this is actually a good analogy for life in general, especially the creative life. Hiking is very analogous to your creative journey, because you're on a journey. And as you hike, you're not only hiking and working out your legs, but you're also working out your mind, because you don't have the distractions of unless you bring your phone with you. But if you don't have your phone with you, you don't have emails, you don't have texts, you don't have the fear of missing out on all these other events that you could be doing that day. From point A when you get on the trail to point B when you get off the trail, you give yourself to the trail. You give yourself to the process of going into the woods to making your way out of the woods. And I feel like the same way with our creative career. We start at the beginning of the trailhead. Sometimes we go through really hard terrain with a bunch of cutbacks and switchbacks and hike mountains. Sometimes it's more peaceful. And sometimes it's beautiful. We're walking in high cotton. There's beautiful meadows everywhere around us. But then sometimes a storm can come through and rain on everything that you've done, and you feel demoralized and you're stuck out there, you know, and you're like, I have two options. I can either die or keep going. And I feel like that's a lot of what it's like when you work for yourself, because sometimes you'll make, you know, sometimes you can make, and I know people out there that make $200,000-$300,000 a year, but I'm not at that place yet. Maybe someday I will be, but the goal for me is not to be a millionaire. The goal for me is to be free. When I'm in the woods, I'm free. Like, I'm connected to the planet. I'm connected to the essence of life and the evolution of life and the cosmos itself. For me, if I work for somebody else in a cubicle, I'm enslaved. And so I would rather forego the golden handcuffs and a $120,000 salary, if that's out there. I don't even know if it would be for me, in order to do the trail and to work out my whole body and to live and die by myself. And so I distilled all that into a design that said, let's get hikedelic. And it was a boot. And it was really popular. It kind of blew up on Instagram and a little bit. I mean, I'm not tooting my own horn, but a lot of people liked it. And that was a clue for me that I had walked through the trail, through the ups and downs of the first part of the trail when I wasn't getting any work, to this valley where I was like, okay, I can walk smoothly through here for a while. But that valley, you can't ride that forever because things change. And so I'm like, okay, what's the next thing? And at that time in my life, just full disclosure, I was really interested in, because, you know, I deal with depression and I deal with, I can deal with it pretty strongly. And so I was kind of turning to psychedelic drugs at that time in my life to help me alleviate that. And so I was experimenting with that, and I no longer do that in my life, because ultimately I have to face this by myself, and nothing from the outside is going to come into my mind and fix my mind. I have to go into my mind and do the hard work, and I have to keep hiking. I can't expect to be carried on the wings of a psychedelic eagle up the mountain, you know, like, that's not going to happen. I gotta keep pushing through. And so, yeah, so that ever since I posted that post, I've had a job ever since, and I haven't gone without work since. And sometimes I have great months, sometimes leaner months, but I'm ultimately happy because I get to do what I love, and people hire me to do what I love to do, and I get to see my work out there. At the end of the day, I'm making art. I'm getting paid to make art that reflects the passions that I have outside of my love of making art. And that's a really, really cool feeling. And I want to be able to share that and help other people achieve that too, because it's absolutely possible. If I can do it, someone with no training, anybody can really do this, you know, but it's hard. It's not easy. And I don't want people out there to think that it's this super, super easy, fun process. It can be. The highs are exhilarating, but the lows can be really low and depressing. But what matters, what separates the person who through hikes the Appalachian Trail to the person who gives up after going through a state, is a determination and a drive and a vision for what that end goal is going to be like. And so in order to get that, it's important to work on your mental state, you know, get out in nature, involve yourself with friends, invest in a relationship with a significant other or some friends, do things outside of design, because those things will end up forming your process and make your design all that better.
If you're not inspired to go outside after hearing that, I don't know what's going to help.
Beautiful world out there.
And it doesn't take very much to find it either. But it does take a lot of work to, in some ways, it takes a lot of mental effort and strain to achieve the idea of being free. This is something I spoke to Scott Fuller about from the Studio Temporary.
Good dude. I love Scott.
His freedom to live. And mm-hmm. He was explaining very heavily a very similar mantra to what you've just kind of explained, which is you'd rather have the freedom to do what you want, when you want, how you want, why you want to, than be tied in golden handcuffs. And I think that maybe a big cultural shift in that way is coming very quickly. And I think the more people I'm talking to about this, the more I'm realizing how true what your statement is, because we have the resources now to do that. And the average person has the resources to do that if they want to. And to have the ability to walk the dog whenever you want. Like I'm probably going to go do that when I finish recording this with you, because, well, firstly, it's a Saturday when we're recording, but even if this was a work day, like I go to the gym in the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah, me quiet. Too. Yep.
Because it's quiet and you can. And it's an absolute privilege to be able to do that. It's an absolute privilege to be able to live and die by your own sword, effectively. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't recognize the strain that can have on your mental health as well.
Yes.
Because, yes. I mean, to go back to the sword point, like the samurai have some pretty dark ways of dealing with bad problems. Literally dying by the sword. So if you apply that to a little bit more mundane design life, it does come down to the fact that having that control comes at a cost. And if you do not make yourself aware of that potential cost, that potential burnout, the potential harm you can do to your physical health by sitting at a desk all day or hunched over, all these practical things, and your mental health, whether that's through comparison or imposter syndrome or just general burnout, there will come a time where you won't be able to go out and hike. There would come a time where you wouldn't be able to go and do the job that you love anymore because you've got RSI in your hands or something like that. And what Ben is saying here is extremely important, because when you run your own thing, it's very easy to forget that there is a world outside of that. And I know that I've forgotten that in the past. And that's something that I still struggle with today, because I live in a town where all of my friends, because of uni and stuff like that, have moved on. And it ends up being very lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And it can actually end up causing more harm than good. Even though you're still passionate about what you want to do, you still have this looming shadow. So I think if there's one thing that you can take away, go and spend a bit more time doing something outside of your design, or literally outside,
mm-hmm.
because that's where you will find and develop your own style, is through life experience, not just through designing and through YouTube videos and social media.
And you know, I think that's so true. And I think especially in these days, everybody has a desire to for attention. Whether, you know, you're a celebrity, or in our case, our president, or everyone's trying to gratiate and feed their ego. And we give so much of ourselves to other people to validate ourselves. And when we, like Connor's saying, when you break that cycle, and when you go outside, especially when you get some alone time in nature or someone else, you realize how interconnected and complex the world is, and how little you truly matter in the grand scheme of things, and how freeing that is. When you realize that you're gonna live for maybe 80 years and then you're gonna die and most people are gonna forget about you, the pressure is off to try to be this big, famous, top of the pack, alpha dog kind of person. And then you allow yourself to work on the things that really bring joy to you. Marie Kondo in that, you know, like that Netflix special about cleaning houses, she says, like, keep the things that spark joy. Keep the things that spark joy in your life. You know, like in America, we have this thing called the American dream, and that's like getting as much money as possible,
much
getting rich, getting famous.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not a dream, because it's a rat race. You're in a hamster wheel your whole life chasing after this stuff. At the end of your life, you might accumulate it all, but then the things that truly matter, you have no time left for. And I guess in my position, I would rather make a modest amount of money doing what I love and giving myself time to be free than to make an exorbitant amount of money on somebody else's time, hating my life. I know so many people that hate their jobs, but they do it for the money because they want the next biggest thing. In my head, I don't really want anything. I have everything that I need. I'm healthy. I have a mind. I have a full head of hair. Oh, that's a joke. You know, I have a wonderful wife and a good family. And I have this beautiful planet that I can commune with and connect with. And I'm happy. Like, if I get nothing else in my life other than that, sure, I have my fights and my battles. And sure, I measure my value based on the amount of income that comes in, just because we're hunters. Like, when you think about humans evolutionarily, before there were jobs or agriculture or anything, we hunted for things. I feel like when you're in the freelance world, you're a hunter too. Sometimes you get a mastodon and sometimes you hunt a quail. But the goal is to be able to save the meat from the mastodon so that when all you're getting is quail, you still got something to eat. And the great thing about hunting, though, is there's an amazing sense of self-satisfaction knowing that you've lived your life on your own terms and that you get to write the story of your life. And again, not everybody is wants to do that. And some people, and I have nothing against agencies or in-house work. They do incredible work. But for those few that want to go on this journey, just know that your backpack is going to be heavy. Your legs are going to be tired, but the views from the top are going to be stunning. And they're in spiritually, I don't know, there's something transformative about, especially the arts, like dealing with something that is so ephemeral and abstract and then making it concrete. Like my friend Martin said, it's like taking that potential energy that is above in the clouds above and then like Zeus or Prometheus, like grabbing it from up there and bringing it down to earth. It's the most amazing thing you'll do, but it's also one of the hardest things you'll do at the same time. I'm sure you can attest to that.
Yeah, you're right. There is deep satisfaction in climbing that mountain either by yourself or with a couple of trusted, very close friends. And I think that agency life, but let's just talk about the general rat race, the general 9-to-5. A lot of people are attracted by the idea of it being an easier path, and it will potentially help you get to that mountain peak faster. But when you get to the top, what do you have? You have a tenth of whatever you've done, because you're surrounded by people all doing the same, or you're part of a team or an agency. And yeah, in some ways, if it's like your own company, that's okay. But if you're in like a big corporate and you get to the top, who are you surrounded by? People all doing the same thing. And now what do you do? Oh, you're probably lonely, sad, burnt out, surrounded by money and not any idea what to do with it. Mm-hmm. But when you do this journey kind of by yourself or with a passion behind it or with a small group of friends, something tight-knit, you take on a lot more responsibility. And as people, I think responsibility is good. It is hard. Mm-hmm. There is no shame in admitting to that. It is hard, exceptionally difficult to take on responsibility, but it is the more gratifying path. And
I have a perfect, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, if something's come to mind, go for it.
You have that. I have a very short story, just more of an illustration that really backs that point up. So a couple years ago, my wife and I were hiking in British Columbia, and there's this mountain that's called the Sea to Sky Trailway. I can't remember the name of the mountain, but it's on the Howe Sound, which is like my last name. Very beautiful, like evergreens everywhere. And there's two ways to get to the top of this mountain. There is a gondola that will take you from the bottom up to the top. Very beautiful, great views, very easy. Or you can do the 7-hour hike from the base of the mountain to the top of the mountain. And it was effing terrible, like in some parts, because you're going up the entire time. You go through so many things. You have to cross streams. You have to go through like brush at certain points. Your legs are tired. You got your pack on you. My wife and I decided to go up the mountain that way. And both ways get you to the top of the mountain. The view is the same, whether you take the gondola up or whether you hike up. But there's a cheapness. And again, I'm not disparaging anyone who goes the traditional route. I mean, I'm not even going to say cheapness, because I mean, the views are still beautiful. But I guess what I'm trying to say is when you hike up there yourself with your pack, you're weary when you get there, but the reward is so much greater because you didn't just sit on your butt and take and coast up. You worked your ass off to get up there. And when you're up there, it's almost like you cross the finish line in a marathon. Like, I remember when I got to the top of that mountain, I like wanted to like kiss the soil. I'm like, I did it. Now I can take the gondola down, you know? And that was one of the, my wife and I, she got some wine, I got a beer, and we overlooked the valley beneath us. And there's like a restaurant up there actually, which is funny. But it was one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done. And there's been other times where I've taken a gondola up to the top. And it was a great time, but it didn't resonate with me the same way as putting in the work to get up there. And again, you can get there either way. And I'll be honest, I have insecurities about myself working for an agency. I've never really actually worked at an agency. I don't know if I'd be a good culture fit. I don't know if I could handle the kind of work that they want. And sometimes I'm like, am I good enough for that? Does my work measure up? Would anybody be interested in hiring me? But again, that's the kind of stuff that tries to get me off the trail and off the course, you know? So, yeah.
And I do have great admiration for people who are willing to do that. And I think as a person who is, or anyone listening who is a creative, wanting to do their own thing or wanting to be part of something that they create, whether that's I keep referring back to the idea of having yourself or a small group of friends or a small tight-knit team, because I think we are tribe people, whether that is with one or three or four, anything less than 10, kind of that's my expectation. But I have great admiration for people who are wanting to do that. And I'm going to butcher the origin. I believe it's some kind of African proverb. I will find out and put a note in the description if I'm wrong, but it's something along the lines of, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Now, that does apply to a certain extent in terms of general life, in terms of having social interaction, of having friends, of having people there to look after you. But I don't think it applies when you come to a 9-to-5. And the people who are willing to hike up that mountain or hike that trail, I have much more admiration for. And I think it's much more rewarding, as you say, much more gratifying to be able to take that journey instead, rather than going quickly. Because as much as you said a minute ago that if you're in good health, I think the average Westerner can live to about 90 something, I think is the average now, if you're in good health. But that's a long time, man. Like 90 years is like a long time.
Yeah.
And to be obsessed with the rat race at 20 or 24, like I am, or you said you were 30.
Yeah,
to be obsessed with the rat race at that age is just killer, I think.
Yeah.
I think you need that perspective. You need that top of mountain view to really set you back.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think a lot of people, when they hit their 40s, they get the midlife crisis. You know, sometimes they cheat on their spouse or they get a new car and they think that these things will make them feel young again.
But
yourself, and you realize what matters in life, and realize that personal happiness and freedom and wholeness and connectedness, which you can really get out in nature more than anything else. Or for some people, it's a religious experience too. They can go to a church or a mosque or a temple or whatever. That offsets a lot of those problems that you have later on. Because a lot of people, they work their ass off, they hit their 40s and 50s, and they're like, what do I have to show for this? I've spent 60 hours a week for the 10 years where I'm at, and this isn't that great. I'm not satisfied by this. I'm not happy by this. Maybe buy more stuff, which is what the economy tells us. Get more things, fill that existential void in yourself. No, the only thing that can fill that void in yourself is yourself. And it's like, essentially Buddha, before he reached Nirvana, he was under the Bodhi tree and he had to face the devil, which really was his own ego. He had to essentially die to his own ego and realize that, no, I have to let go of my attachment to material. I have to let go of my attachment to things that ultimately won't fulfill me, and realize that I can only find peace from within. And I think that in the creative world, it's the same way. We have to face our ego. We have to say, whether I become a Aaron Draplin or just a no-name guy that just does great work for people in my community, it doesn't matter. That's up to fate. That's not up to me. My responsibility is to do the best work that I can, to treat my clients with respect, to be honest, to be ethical, to not rip off people, to encourage people along the way, to not worry about being a star, but just worry about shining, like the work shine for itself. Because think about it, man, when you're making a design for a client, you're giving them something. You're not selling them a gun or a beer or, you know, fixing their pipes in their house. You're giving them something that they can be proud of. Like, there's nothing more gratifying than that. And to me, just the simple act of being able to be paid to create and to offer my creation to others is fulfillment enough for me. And I actually reached this epiphany yesterday, because in my head, I always get the pressure. I have a friend who owns an ad agency actually here in Columbus. And he's one of my biggest inspirations. And he has got so much work. He does so much things. And he's very successful at what he does in the amount of work that people he works with. And sometimes I compare myself to him, and he's about my age. I'm like, man, I'm 30. He's 32. I'm 31. I wish I could be there. But then I think to myself, he also has a bunch of different stresses on a bigger scale than I do, because he's working on all these accounts and arranging all these things. And it's so easy for us to compare ourselves to others, what would others have, but that robs us of the joy of realizing the gifts that we've been given and how wonderful it is to be able to take those gifts and not only help ourselves, but to help others. And I feel like, especially in the design world, if you help other people out and if you give them a hand up instead of pushing them away, they're going to speak highly of you. They're going to be excited by what you do, and they're going to give you a good name. I mean, respect is either demanded or it's earned. And I would much rather earn the respect of other people than say, look at me, I'm the hot shit, I'm a great designer, follow my stuff. No, I'd rather say, hey, I love what I do. If you love it too, let's have a conversation. If I can help you, if you're inspired by what I do, copy my stuff. Just, you know, don't rip me off, but you please copy what I do. And if that's going to help you get to where you want to be, because ultimately when you're in nature, you realize that the ecosystem from the microscopic to the macroscopic is all intertwined and connected. And we as humans have divorced ourselves from this understanding by putting ourselves in boxes from the day that we're born until the day that we die. When we're in the womb, we're connected in utero, in the umbilical cord, we're connected to our mother. When we are living on this planet, we should also be connected to our mother, the Mother Earth, right? And tomorrow is Mother's Day. And I was thinking about that. Like, how many of us, you know, are born, we're in a crib, and then we go into a house, and then as we're little kids, then we go to a primary school, secondary school, university, we're in a car, we're looking at a phone, we come home and we watch a television. And then we go into a nursing facility, nursing home, and then we end up in a box underground for the rest of our life. Like, I don't think that that's natural, and I don't think that that's healthy. And if we can break that cycle and live holistically on this beautiful planet that we have, then it shows us that success is not a sequence of boxes, but that success is truly letting down your roots and being rooted where you are and finding content and nourishment and peace from there and growing, you know, at the place that you've been planted, you know. So
being your own star and shining as brightly as you physically can. And exactly. On that note, I really appreciate you taking the time to join me for today's episode, Ben. I think we've covered a lot of deeper topics. I think you need to come back at some point so we can continue this conversation. We've already gone well past an hour, and I really appreciate anyone who has stuck around to listen to the end of this. And if you have, please do share the show on any social platform you wish. You can find and tag us at Howes Design Service, I believe is your tag. And
yes,
so find me at C Fowler Design. I'm just going to leave it there today. I would say go and subscribe and do all this type of stuff, but I feel a bit more awakened after this conversation and a bit lightheaded, honestly, with the amount that we have discussed. So Ben, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, well, first of all, Connor, thank you so, so much for having me on here. I'm just a guy who grew up in rural Ohio. I'm nobody special. I'm nobody important. But I love what I do. And I know if you're listening to this podcast, especially if you stuck around through all our shenanigans to this point, that you love what you do too. And so I personally want to encourage you, whoever you are, to keep at it, to keep hiking, to keep putting stuff in your backpack and keep going on this journey, because I believe in you. I know you can do it. And if you're interested in seeing what I do, I'm on Instagram at all one word, Howes Design Service. I'm also on Dribbble at, I think it's just Howes Design on Dribbble. If you just type in Howes Design, I'll show up. And I have a website, so I need to work on it. It's not as good as it could be, but, you know, we're all working on stuff. It's howesdesignservice.com. And if you do follow me and have any questions or want to ask me a question personally, please, people reach out to me a lot, and I'm always happy to speak with them and to encourage if I can. So, and thank you again, Connor, for having me. It's been a complete honor to be on your podcast.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. All of those links you will find in the description in today's show notes, and we'll be back next time for another episode of The Fowler Hour. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.